The Faces We Wear, a Jungian Perspective on the Quest for Self.
And now for part 3. Hello, my name is Lucy Hanek. My guest is John Durley. He's a Jungian analyst and a priest with the Oblates of Mary Immaculate. This morning, we're going to tackle the unconscious. In Jungian psychoanalysis, the unconscious is accessed through dreams. And so naturally, my first question to John Durley is, so what's in a dream?
Well, I think what a dream contains is the, or is a depiction, as I've said, of what the deepest source of wisdom in the individual has for that individual. Jung calls that the self, and understands the self as the dream maker. And the dream maker in the dream gives its view of how it perceives the ego or consciousness. That can constellate a number of relationships between consciousness and the self, as the self mediates its position through the dream, so that the dream leads the center of consciousness, the ego, into a discussion with the self about what might be needed for one's greater totality or wholeness or completion or balance. It would be false to say that the ego must simply, as it were, fall down before the dream, before the self, and mechanistically implement whatever gets said. But if you follow the dreams for some time, you'll see a pattern emerge that becomes quite intelligible to both the analyst and the analysand. And this takes the form of the dreams urging consciousness to move in this way or that way toward a fuller conscious perspective, a more complete perspective.
So you're almost drawn into the narrative of the true self?
Jung wouldn't use a true and false self. He would really use the... you brought up a good point there, because in our culture, unfortunately, since we've been cut off from our depths, I think basically by a combination of science and religion, self means simply ego or consciousness. When you say myself or herself or its other, you're referring to, usually the self means consciousness. Now, Jung is arguing that that the self is really something that is other than consciousness. It's continuous with consciousness, but it's autonomous. It has its own position in the psyche, which is dominant, and that the goal of the dream is to enable the self to enter into consciousness more fully. And as it does that, it will broaden consciousness, make it more complete, more empathic, give it a wider embrace. But that often can be a very painful process, in so much as one has to face, for instance, the shadow, which would be one's unrealized potentialities that would turn against one unless they're allowed to enter consciousness, you know?
So when we're sleeping and mm-hmm. we're dreaming, we're mm-hmm. tapping into our unconscious, and when we wake up and we remember, we're almost, the act of remembering our dreams, the unconscious part of ourselves, is bringing it into our consciousness and educating who we, in a sense, are.
Well, it would be the first step in it.
Okay.
Like I encourage, well, if one moves into a full analytic situation, the recording of the dreams becomes very important, central to the whole process. And I have dreamers date their dream so that we can identify the night, what was going on the previous day, what was being anticipated the next day or days. And it's in the recording of the dream that you get the narrative, so to speak, the self is saying. I think the whole process, as I've said, is one of private revelation. And just as traditional Christians or Muslims or Jews will reflect on their sacred scripture, one has also to reflect on the dream as one's personal revelation. It also has a transformative power. It's difficult totally to resist what's getting said. And usually there's a lot of resistance because the perspective of the self is often quite different and down-putting than the perspective of the ego. Just as to illustrate that, Jung was working with a socialite one time who was inflated, meaning she had an unreal perception of her goodness, as it were. And one of the dreams depicted her as working in a pigsty, you see, so that this wonderful woman, who was so filled with herself, was shown to be really a peasant. So that would show the difference between how one would perceive oneself consciously and how the self would perceive this individual. And it would initiate a dialogue then. Well, do you think you're a little high on your self-perception? What are you doing in a pigsty? So forth, you know.
If dreams are such a part of the gateway into the whole self, why then aren't more people interpreting their dreams?
Yeah, Jung's position is that the work of the psyche is never over. The process of the self becoming conscious in consciousness never ends. So that the most we ever do in life is approximate the reality of the self in consciousness. So, for instance, from a Jungian perspective, if somebody came up and said, well, I'm perfect now, it's over, I and the unconscious are one, I and my father are one, whatever, you'd immediately suspect inflation or that the person hadn't really gone into oneself very, very deeply, you know. So that you do have to realize that there's a dialectic involved here in this sense that Jung would be arguing that we are driven to realize the self in consciousness. And yet at the same time, that process can never be more than approximated. It can never end right up to the moment of death. And he has some really strange perspectives on that. One of his arguments for immortality, so to speak, is that in the face of death, the self goes on making dreams. And he doesn't specify what it would be, but he feels that that kind of points to some type of continuity after death. The very fact that the self remains interested in the development of the individual prior to death.
In talking about the work that it requires to get into the narratives of the dreamer's dream, we get into further terminology in Jungian analysis, and that's the shadow. Where does it come from, and what are its components? John Durley explains.
The assimilation of the shadow, what's forbidden to your conscious personality, strengthens that personality. It's like embracing the demonic, becoming unified with one's dark side, which then becomes brighter, or at least qualifies one's light, bright, intellectual side. And there's usually a personal strength derived from that that alters the relationship to the feminine in the male and to the masculine in the female. And depending on where the person is when they enter analysis, one common variant would be something like this, that because an individual had not accepted their shadow, they are relating to males or to females with a desiccated ego personality. And when that occurs, there's a possibility that they are relating deeply to what I call mother's choice, that the individual could not assimilate the shadow to the point where she or he could break externally, if you look at it that way, with the mother. And so marries into the mother's choice or the mother's ideal in a male or the mother's ideal in a female, and that's very, very difficult to work with.
Mm-hmm.
You have to see what would happen when the individual becomes stronger, as an individual breaks either the mother's values or even collective value, because we're rendered deeply unconscious by our collective consciousness, our commitments to, like, what a woman should be, or what a man should be, or what a Canadian should be, or what a Catholic should. These are all forms of collective consciousness which limit our freedom.
Jung talked a lot about archetypes and the mother archetype being the strongest. Can you talk about the mother archetype and how it comes out in our dreams?
In the final analysis, you have to affirm in its depth, Jung psychology is profoundly, I would say, maternal. And so I think he has rediscovered for our age the great mother or the great goddess. And I think this was the way that he broke with Freud. He saw this goddess as existing at a deeper level in the psyche than Freud's psychology could contain. There was a deeper dimension. But I think it's really Volume 5 where he goes to his first discussion of what gets to be the great mother. And he talks about the dual mother, and just to try to analyze that intellectually, like I think he calls the collective unconscious maternal, because it gives birth to consciousness, so that the deepest dimension of the psyche is maternal because it births all consciousness. A second reason why it's maternal is that it is the... you have to use a kind of spatial or geographic language to describe this, and it always falsifies what you're trying to say. But the basic idea would be that the great goddess contains the archetype.
Okay.
The archetypes really lie at the level of the collective unconscious, and the collective unconscious for Jung is simply a scientific, so to speak, term or technical term.
Could one say that Jung was fascinated by the feminine because he was a man? I pose the question to John Durley.
No, I think he would say that because he came to realize that there were depths to the psyche that Freud could not contain, into which he went in the breakdown he had after his split with Freud. And there he saw the power, you might say face to face, of these deeper levels of the unconscious. Which means this, that unfortunately people come into analysis only when they're suffering greatly, say from hatred of men or hatred of women or hatred of the father, hatred of the mother, or just the opposite, love of women, too many of them, or of men, too many of them. Or that they've got involved in some kind of an ism, like globalism or socialism, or in French they say Christianism, and they realize that what's happened is that they've been devoured by the ism.
In my conversation with Jungian analyst John Durley, I asked him, what is the individual, say, in North America, and do they have an understanding of the self? And does an understanding of the self have to require a crisis, always?
I think the concrete situation in North America at this moment is this, that people will only move into this form of spirituality when they're driven to it by pain in their life. And then the dialogue with the unconscious starts, and the pain is examined. And we get to see what is working this pain or causing this suffering or disrupting this life. That's the way it would work, you know.
Dreams offer the ego information, advice, constructive criticism, even wisdom. If the ego is receptive rather than defensive, it can evaluate these alternative perspectives and decide whether to accept or reject them. If the individual allows the ego to receive the information of the dream, to integrate the message of the dream into its conscious state, the person moves into individuation, a Jungian term, or in other words, into a wholeness of self, into an understanding of what it means to be fully known. Jungian analyst John Durley further explains.
Individuation is based upon the process of consciousness re-entering the mother. And the mother is a universal process. It's like Jesus said, unless you get... He's talking to Nicodemus, and he says, unless you enter the womb again, you cannot enter whatever it is, the kingdom of heaven, or you cannot get to what you're looking for religiously unless you re-enter the womb. And Nicodemus, of course, a great literalist, at least this is the way the Johannine author sets it up, says, but I'm 5'6" or 7", my mother's just a tiny little woman. How can I re-enter the womb? You know, that same kind of literalism that besets our society. But I'd like to say this, the factor in Jungian psychology that distinguishes individuation from individualism is the fact that it works on a cycle. And the nature of that cycle is that consciousness, again through the dreams, enters into the mother and then hopefully enters back into society reborn. Now, where I've been doing work on Jung and the mystics, you know, and some of the mystics go into this nothingness where they simply are not, but... in not being, they are paradoxically at one with God. And that's, or more than that, they're identical with God. It has profound affinities with Jung's understanding of the deeper ingression into the mother. One goes back and experiences this moment of depth, even perhaps as the mystics do in nothingness, that... They take as identity with the divine, and then they return to society, and they're strengthened by it, even though it's a painful process, and particularly giving it up is painful. They are strengthened by this process, and then they can they have a heightened consciousness and relationality. And that can go either way. It can go into a very positive contribution to society, or it can be prophetic. It can be, because it's more sensitive to the pain in society, it can be very socially critical. But that kind of criticism, I think, is of a different nature than simply setting up some kind of an intellectual structure, which when it works usually has an archetypal basis, and then saying this is the intellectual structure that society should have and we're going to implement it.
In order for us to get to that point where we are participating out of the self that belongs, we have to enter into the mother. What does that look like, entering into the mother?
Well, it would look like moving much more deeply into the source of our consciousness, into the... Jung will talk about the matrix mind. He also uses medieval terms like prima materia, the prime matter, that out of which consciousness evolves. He also refers to the ocean, to the abyss, and so forth. And I think it would... Now, admittedly, most people don't undergo... the kind of total
into
immersion.
Into the abyss. Yeah.
They usually don't go totally into the abyss. And Jung himself, I think, was afraid of some of the mystics and of Eastern thought, where the idea of overcoming the ego or negating the ego was the formulation. And I think he imposed Western views on that. And from the viewpoint of Western psychiatry and psychology, a total and continued negation of the ego would be psychosis, you know. There would be just no ego there. But what Jung has in mind, an entrance into the mother, I think, is allowing the self to orchestrate that entrance. And the orchestration is done through the dream. So that anybody who's following their dreams through a period of time or through life, is moving ever more deeply into the maternal dimensions of the psyche and coming back with a greatly enhanced consciousness, individuating in the sense that one is relating to the very specific circumstances around oneself out of some type of resonance with the ground of being or the source of consciousness herself in one way or the other. And that can again lead to contributions, or it can lead to criticisms. It can lead to usually maybe a little bit of both, that as one becomes more conscious, one can see how constricted various forms of collective consciousness, like, for instance, global, anything that ends in ISM, is usually a form of tribalism. And the problem with a tribe is they have tremendous unity, but nobody is conscious.
And in a time when the word conscious and consciousness is used at the drop of a hat, it's difficult to know what ism any of us are secretly or unconsciously following. But something inside of us always tells us. Dreams wake us up, and we are left with the leftover images of our dreams that many times are difficult to understand. Jungian analyst John Durley leaves us with much terminology and insight to ponder over. But he also leaves us with a simple advice. If you want to know who you really are, write down your dreams. Honestly, they will tell.